Hello and welcome to Independent Thinking, the weekly podcast from Chatham House. I'm Bronwyn Maddox, the director, and back with you after last week in Japan. This week, we're looking closely at two of West Africa's key democracies, Senegal and Nigeria. Both represent vibrant examples of the region's rich democratic traditions, but both are facing key challenges. Senegal, as the New York Times said, should have been one of Africa's more boring elections, but no. In February, Senegalese President Macky Sall threw his country into crisis by attempting to delay the election, the presidential election, and the country seen as one of the most stable in the region, the only one in mainland West Africa never to have had a military coup, suddenly had deadly rioting on the streets. The elections are now back on, but what has been the damage? We're going to talk about that. Meanwhile, in Nigeria, the powerhouse of the region is in deep economic crisis, the worst in a generation. The north of the country is again facing a spate of kidnappings after armed groups abducted over 280 school children, most between 8 and 15 years old, earlier this month. Year on from its own presidential election, we're going to talk about whether Nigeria is re-entering a period of insecurity that many people had hoped it had left behind. And then finally, we're going to talk about what all this means for the Sahel, where in the last 3 years, Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso have all had military coups, leaving them isolated both from neighbours in West Africa and governments in the Europe and the US. With the French out, Americans leaving, the UN caught in the middle, are Russians filling the power vacuum? These are huge topics, and we can't hope to cover all of them. Never mind all of West Africa in this episode, but we have a great panel to at least raise and talk about some of the main questions. Joining me down the line from Dakar in Senegal is Gilles Yabi, founder and CEO of WATHI, the West Africa Citizen Think Tank. Welcome.
Morning.
Great to have you here. And joining us from just outside London is Idayat Hassan, a senior associate with CSIS in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Great to have you here. And finally, in the studio with me is Paul Melly, a consulting fellow with our Africa program. Welcome.
Good morning. Nice to be with everyone.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this conversation that we are trying to cover an awful lot of ground. Let's start with the events in Senegal and Nigeria, and in fact, start with Senegal. Gilles, I wonder if you could take us into it. Tell us a bit about why this particular election matters so much.
Yeah, again, it's a pleasure to be with you. I think it's still quite mysterious the reason why President Macky Sall, a few hours before the start of electoral campaign, decided to postpone the election. That was on 3rd of February, and that created a situation of a political and institutional crisis and a lot of fear that this year going to be disrupted by political instability in Senegal, which has been one of the few stable countries under democratic rule for a number of years. So now we have this election next Sunday, 24th of March. And this was really the result both of internal pressure from various political and social forces of the country, and also the fact that the constitutional courts decide really to make sure that constitution is respected. And it was basically the constitutional court that obliged the government to have this presidential election. And it is important also to know that the term of President Macky Sall is going to end on 2nd of April. So now we have a first round of election, possibly a runoff. But the idea is that at least if we have only a few weeks after the end of the mandate of Macky Sall, we should have a new elected president. And just to say a bit about the why this election is particularly important. It's the first time that you have a sitting president who is not candidate to election. It's also a situation where you have a very strong polarization between the candidate who represent now Macky Sall coalition, Amadou Ba, a former prime minister, and on the other side, a very strong opposition candidate, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, who is actually replacing Ousmane Sonko, who is the well-known personality from the opposition. So we have 19 candidates, but I think it is possible that we'll have very important results going to either Amadou Ba or Bassirou Diomaye Faye, and this kind of polarization of the political scene.
Thank you for that incredibly clear summary. And there's been a lot of argument about whether some candidates were eligible to run or not. I was trying to draw myself a map ahead of this podcast of who was in jail, who'd been out, who was released from jail, who could run, who wasn't eligible. Is it, in your view, a proper and vigorous and fair slate of candidates running?
Yeah, it is quite difficult to summarize the situation because there have been so many developments in the last 2-3 years in Senegal. And it is, in my opinion, very clear that one of the reasons why we have all these difficulties around organizing the election was the fact that President Macky Sall himself was initially hoping to be able to be candidate again for a third time. It was very clear that he was under pressure, internal pressure and external pressure, that President Macky Sall decided not to run for the election while insisting that he was actually legally authorized to be candidate again. And I think a lot of effort have been put into kind of picking the candidate and making sure that the strong opposition candidate would not be able to be on the list, that Ousmane Sonko. Actually, Ousmane Sonko has been condemned. Now you have an amnesty law. He was released, but Ousmane Sonko is not candidate to this election because the final list of candidate was already approved by the Constitutional Court. That's why you have someone, the number two of his party, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, not a very charismatic personality, but very strong, good friend and very close to Ousmane Sonko, is going to replace him basically on the list of candidates. I think that with 19 candidates, former prime ministers, former ministers, one woman, only one, unfortunately, you still have a very rich political offer, which is, which is being proposed to the citizens in Senegal. And I think most of the Senegalese people were ready to go to the election, even if they were not happy about the possibility of the candidacy of Ousmane Sonko, even if they were not happy about the conditions that led to this election.
Gilles, again, thank you. You've described and summarized what has been an incredibly complicated series of events extremely well. Itayat, I would love your view on this, of whether, as Gilles has described, you know, this really is a healthy sign. This is a president stepping down, agreeing, even if a bit reluctantly, that this is the end of his term and you have a vigorous election here.
Yeah, I think it's a very healthy one for us in West Africa. It's again what comes back to show that there is actually people's power at a point in time where we find that democracy is regressing in the region with more than 47% coup, successful and attempted coup. We saw citizens push back across board, both young and old, women, religious leaders, and they were able to have their say. And a president could not actually have what we call the constitutional coup d'etat, where you actually change the constitution back to zero and you get the opportunity to vie again. So it's a positive for us. And I think this is like the icing on the cake in a region that has had very depressive outlook in the last 3 years, really.
And what do you think the top concern of voters is going to be?
I think really it's about the concern will be the acceptability of outcome again will be important here. It's not just about food. It's not just about economy. It's not just about all those things. We must not also forget that, as Giles has actually described, you have two people, two godfathers, like we will say in Nigeria, vying in these elections. Macky Sall on the one hand, which is Amadou Ba, and Ousmane Sonko actually pushing the candidacy of his second in command from his own party. So people are going to line up voting along these lines. It's either a vote for Macky or a vote for Ousmane Sonko, which, if care is not taken, actually leads to more polarization in the country, not just political, but ethnic based as well.
Paul, should we relax and think Senegal is back on this healthy, even boring to use the New York Times' word, path again? Or is this a picture of a deeply polarized country, very worried about its economy?
Thanks, Bronwyn. I think actually the New York Times was wrong to start off by saying that it should have been a boring election. Because as Gilles pointed out, Senegal has been in crisis for 3 years. It's important to sort of jump back here to 2012, when Macky Sall was first elected in a wave of popular euphoria, where he was the man who was going to reassert democratic values. He was also going to deliver better public services, reduce poverty and all that kind of thing. But as Idayat has pointed out, for Senegalese, it's not just about the cost of living and public services. the value of their political system and their democratic traditions really matters. And so back in 2012, 12 years ago, Macky Sall was the man who encapsulated that. He was the candidate who infused huge crowds on the street in the name of restoring democracy because the previous president had sort of tested the rules to their limit and had tried to promote the role of his son. So that's why this is such a huge test now, because Senegal, there's been this boiling impatience for the last 2 or 3 years as various legal obstacles, in fact, even further back than that, where various legal obstacles have cropped up, court cases that, while they often have a foundation in a real issue, are also clearly politically motivated and seem designed to sort of derail opposition challengers. There's a former mayor of Dakar who is, in fact, now running in this election, but who was blocked from the last one over a relatively minor financial misdemeanor. So this is about restoring Senegalese faith in their institutions. And I think it also really matters for West Africa as a whole at a time when so many people, particularly younger people in the cities, are really disillusioned with their civilian political class. As Hidayat says, you know, we've had these constitutional coups where incumbent presidents have changed the rules. Only a few days ago in Benin, the government pushed through a change which will make it incredibly difficult for the only opposition party that is in parliament to win a substantial number of seats next time. And those kind of manipulations have really disenchanted younger people. And that's also contributed to the conditions in which these coups d'etat have taken place. And I know we're going to talk later about
that. We're going to talk later about that. But let me ask you the point that I've asked Gilles and Hidayat of whether you think that on the whole, this is a healthy election, that this says something about the vigour of Senegal's democracy.
I think you could say yes. In this sense, possibly the biggest winner out of this process is the Constitutional Court, who 12 years ago, people were questioning whether the Constitutional Court really would stand up to presidents. And twice in the last 2 or 3 months of manoeuvres, essentially it's faced down Macky Sall and simply told him that his various proposals for procrastinating and fiddling around with the election were unacceptable.
Gilles, just take us a little bit into the future. When are we going to know the results? This is, of course, the first round that we're looking at.
Generally, at the end of the election day in Senegal, you start having kind of local results. So I would expect quite clear tendencies, basically 24 hours later. We should have some good idea about the results. But I would say that we, of course, have to wait for the election to be able to comment on the quality of the electoral process, because my concern now is actually the quality of the organization, the fact that the campaign was very, very short, and also the duration of the final electoral preparations. And there's always the risk of manipulation and trying to prevent some people from some stronghold from the opposition, for example, to be able to vote. There are various ways to disrupt the election, to manipulate the electoral. It's more difficult in Senegal than in many other countries, but I think we still have to be cautious about the quality of the process. And it's extremely important, given the level of polarization, that actually we have a proper process that gives confidence to the people that their choices is going to be respected.
We'll keep an eye on all that. Let's turn to Nigeria, as I said, we are going to. And Hidayat, I wonder if you could, again, start us off in talking about the abductions in Borno and Kaduna states. Who might have been behind this?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, in the last couple of weeks, we've had a resurgence of abductions in Nigeria. And it's quite interesting that most of these abductions, in particular, targeted school children, which on the eve of the Chibok abductions, which will be 10 years in few days itself. So this is telling a story that as a country, we are yet to get it right, really. But who has done this? I think we do know that. We know that for the Northeast, in the Borno state, these abductions of the internally displaced persons were done by the Islamist group, most particularly the Islamic State in the West African province, are alleged to have actually been responsible for these abductions, really. While in the Northwest, where school children, over 280 school children were taken away as well, this time around, it's what we call the bandits, these insurgent bandits or terrorist bandits, as we call them, a group of outlaws, criminals who operate in the northwestern part of the country, who took away these children, or like my son says, stole the children and took them away. And we are talking about children from between the age of 6 to like 15 years old. I think this is really worrying. It's an unfortunate incident, and it's one that many wish would not have happened.
And we should remember that 10 years on from Chibok, many of those girls are still missing. Gilles, what has been the government response and the police response to these abductions?
Well, I think Hidayat is probably the best place to respond to that on Nigeria. But I think more generally,
you travel quite a lot across the region.
Yes, of course. I also follow what's going on there. Unfortunately, this is not new. And I think that the security forces in Nigeria have showed their weaknesses for some time now, for some years. And of course, I think the current administration is trying to make a significant change. But I don't see for now a clear signs of progress of change in the conduct of the security forces. And I think it's probably a lot about prevention, not just responding to abduction, but creating situation where you can actually have more permanent presence of security forces and also have a level of confidence between the security forces and the people and the communities, so that actually the communities can also be a significant part of the prevention of adoption and of the fight against these criminal groups. But I think it is criminality and violence in Nigeria is something that has been there for years, even for decades. And it seems that it's now extremely difficult to find quick solution. And I don't really believe in quick solution, but I think that what would be good is to at least realize that politically there is an effort to get the intelligence, collective intelligence of a Nigerian society to be able to find lasting solutions.
I'm just going to ask Paul for a second, because Chatham House has been doing a lot of work in Nigeria in different ways. What does this tell us about the security situation?
I think it tells us a couple of things. One is just this fundamental question of confidence about the functioning of what is by far the largest state in West Africa. Remember, we're talking over 220 million people. This is a huge society, and governing it is always going to be very complex, but we're realizing under the huge social and development pressures, as well as the political and security pressures, how difficult it is to make that function. And I think we also need to see this in a regional context. Many of the things that people talk about, the problems in Nigeria, in the north, are also things where you can see parallels with the deep social and security problems, economic problems that you have across the wider Sahel. I mean, I remember back in 2017 with a colleague from Chatham House, we did a research project in the north of Nigeria and southern Niger, and we were able to travel basically between Maradi in Niger and Kano in Nigeria up and down that main road without any worries at all, doing meetings with farmers in villages and this kind of thing. And now that would be incredibly much more difficult and risky. The conditions in both countries wouldn't permit the same sort of thing. And that's just a measure of the sort of stress and deterioration that we're seeing in so many parts of the region.
Idiat, could you just describe for us the economic situation in Nigeria at the moment? I'm hesitating to use the word crisis, but people do scatter that around quite a bit, at least as far as the currency goes, and inflation and food rationing and so on. Has this come very suddenly?
Yeah, I think this is actually sodding. We do have a cost of living crisis in Nigeria. I think that's just the crux of the matter. It's become extremely difficult for people to put food on the table, to get their 3 square meals. I think that's the biggest. It's not just about the deterioration of the currency. It's really about the fact that the inflation that we have is impacted on food prices more than any other thing. And that makes it very difficult for people. But what we must also highlight is that at every point in time, this is something waiting to happen. It's been waiting to happen due to bad choices, not just of previous governments, of course, coupled with the unplanned removal of fuel subsidy by the new administration itself.
This is President Tinubu's administration. You would put some of the blame on him too.
Yes, of course. I think the removal of fuel subsidy without proper planning, which of course all the 3 candidates agreed to pursue during the elections. There was a unison by all the 3 frontline candidates, either the Peter Obi of the Labour Party, Atiku Abubakar of the People's Democratic Party, and Bola Ahmed Tinubu of the All Progressive Congress, who eventually emerged winner, that they would actually remove fuel subsidy. But it could have actually been faced better. But these are challenges that have been coming. In fact, from the last administration, really, which touted itself to be with a toga of anti-corruption, we discovered eventually that it was actually much more corrupt than the former government of President Goodluck Jonathan itself. So lots of bad choices have actually led us to where we are currently in Nigeria. But moving forward is what Nigeria are actually looking at. And by moving forward, what really matters to most people is really the ability to put food on the table. Now, the response of the government itself in the long run is what we will know. Will it be lasting? So the government has actually introduced a lot of what we call palliatives, like interventions in the country. We have food. Food has been released from the silos to different parts of the country to share. There has been intervention fund of like $50, less than $50 now, considering the depreciation of dollars, maybe like $25 to cushion the effect of the fuel subsidy. So at every point in time, this current administration is responsive, unveiling one intervention or the other. But how lasting will that intervention be in the long term? What is the long term? Would you look at that on one hand, and if that is even enough as we keep getting skyrocketing prices of food?
So this is really painful what you're describing, and many economists have been looking at that. But I have in mind as well that the IMF, which made a recent visit to Nigeria, was slightly more positive in the report, looking at the results that may flow from the undeniably painful fiscal discipline that President Tinubu has brought, and that could lead to increased growth in the future, even if it is, as you describe, very, very painful in the short term. Gilles, what do you make of that kind of assessment?
Well, I think that, when you have a regular report every 6 months of the IMF or the World Bank or various institutions, of course, you have an indication of what is expected in terms of growth maybe for the following year. But what matters for the population is what's happening now. And I think what they had just described is the reality of most Nigerians. And you cannot just explain to them that the situation is going to improve and that the economic growth will come at one point because of a fiscal discipline. It is extremely difficult, I think we have to be honest, and the fact that when you have a new administration coming, there is no easy solution, and it's extremely difficult. Even if you make very good economic policies, the results are not going to be seen very quickly. So I think that's why political discourse is important when you can't provide immediate solution to economic and social problems, at least in terms of what you are showing in terms of fighting inequality, in terms of giving indication that you are really fighting corruption, that can give just hope for the people that the situation is going to improve really. But you cannot just tell them that you need fiscal discipline and that the life will be better because you will have more important economic growth. And again, I think it is very important now to that we don't focus on the figure of economic growth, because you can have a significant economic growth just because you have, for example, an improved oil production. And we know that that does not necessarily translate into an actual improvement of the well-being of people. So we need really to look at various indicators of well-being and not just to economic growth to be able to appreciate the effort that are being made in Nigeria.
Some very persuasive skepticism there. Paul, President Tinubu, right or wrong, he spoke at Chatham House just before the election. What do you make of what he's been doing economically?
Well, I think as Hidayat pointed out, there was quite a wide agreement that something had to be done about the previous level of fuel subsidies. And there was a sense with the previous government of a sort of immobilism. It didn't want to seem to want to take big decisions in its last year or two in power. But a huge amount depends on how you go about making changes and how carefully you plan them and whether you really think about, I mean, the IMF, after all, it may think that these will improve the economic indicators, but the IMF has a long track record built up over the last few years, actually, of advising African governments on social measures and phasing measures and how to restructure public spending so that you protect the poor when you are making these difficult economic choices. And I think it's a reminder that this is particularly sensitive right across West Africa, because this is still one of the world's poorer regions. And in those areas with a Sahelian climate, whether it's northern Nigeria or whether it's the so-called Sahel countries themselves, these are some of the poorest places on earth. The margins of economic margins that people have to survive are quite slender. So decisions that government takes that have a sudden shock impact are very, very hard to cope with. And you really need to think about how it's going to affect basic household incomes, basic sort of access to services. For example, you know, one thinks of fuel prices, but of course that then has a knock-on effect, the cost of transport, the cost of moving goods, the cost of farmers sending their crops to market in the cities. So sudden decisions can have much more widespread impacts than people often think.
I've been nodding as you were talking, and I think you're right that the IMF has tried harder recently to work with governments on the social impact of some of these things that it might be recommending. There's obviously been a lot of comment in the past week in the home pages of British newspapers talking about the impact on drop in the numbers of Nigerian students and the impact on British universities. So just the, if you like, parochial lens on that. Paul, you were talking about the Sahel, and let's use that as the reason to talk on about our final subject, which is the military coups in the Sahel. And just picking up on what you were saying, do you think that there is a connection between the economic conditions you've been describing and the coups that we saw across the Saharan belt right across Africa that we saw in the past year or so?
I think there's a connection between the economic conditions and the security crisis in the Sahel, because there is a real crisis in the always very fragile model of rural livelihoods. And the Sahel is overwhelmingly rural society. And you have high population growth, you have climate change, so that the hot seasons are hotter than they were before, the rains are less predictable, and you have now this security crisis with these jihadist armed groups which are disrupting basic development and basic services across the region. And they sort of feed on each other, because the more difficult the social and economic conditions become, then you have more young men, more teenagers, who don't see an opportunity in sort of viable livelihoods. And those are the conditions in which then the armies struggle to tackle the violence, struggle to get security under control. Of the four countries in ECOWAS, the West African bloc, that have had coups, I think you can say the coups in Mali and in Burkina Faso particularly were pushed by frustrations in the military with the security situation. But politics also comes into it, because in Guinea, which is not in the Sahel, there was also a coup, and that was motivated, really pushed by frustration with the civilian elected president, manipulating the constitution and undermining the democratic framework, if you like. And in Niger, it was more of a sort of palace politics, rivalries internally. So all these factors are fitting together. It's a very complex jigsaw.
It is very complex, and the conditions in each country are obviously different. I don't want to imply that there's a single factor, but economics and security are in the mix in many of them. Idiat, what happens now? We've had these military coups in many countries. We see the military leaders in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger forming something of a new alliance outside of ECOWAS. What happens now to the way West African countries deal with each other?
I think that it's whatever happens, it's going to be two-way. The formation of the Alliance des Etats Sahel, the AES Alliance by the Troika, yes, for them it might be a welcome development, but I think it has more huge implication economic-wise and as it relates to freedom of movement and access to resources for them than even for the whole of West Africa. The ECOWAS block itself, because in Nigeria alone, we have more than 13,000 Burkinabes working in Nigeria. So how are they able to work if they are out of ECOWAS, really? In terms of the funds and support they access from ECOWAS, considering that they are also very fragile countries themselves, like this is all gone. Even the ability to service their loans has been challenged this last couple of months. So yes, so there might be a lot of slogan, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of populism, but I continue to hope that this populism that these three countries are pushing does not eventually lead to isolationism at the end of the day for them, really. I think for ECOWAS, the big picture is that from a 15-member country, we often joke now to say that it's just an 11-state party or just 11-member, four people are out or suspended. But ECOWAS has actually extended its hands to these countries, but they have refused to pick the baton, which is all in the bid to prevent elections from happening in this country, as in these countries, really, and for their opportunity to actually work and engage with more liberal actors. At the end of the day, what is really at stake is not the relationship between country to country, but the implication on the citizens of those countries, really. That is what matters the most. And it seems, and the way it looks, it's as if a lot of populism is actually being sold to the citizenry of these three countries, in particular Burkina, Mali, and Niger, without emphasis on their well-being in the long term. And also the security challenges that this boards, not just for the countries, but for the region, with more than 2,500 forces by the time, if eventually the 1,100 U.S. Forces leave Niger, moving out just from Niger alone, what will be the safety and security of the people? What will be the safety and security of the territory? It gives an opportunity for those bad actors, which has led us to this coup d'etat, as Paul has earlier mentioned, to ride roughshod across the region, with conflict moving from Sahel into coastal West Africa. So it's West Africa that is actually being endangered at the end of the day.
Gilles, what do you think happens now?
Oh, I fully agree with what Daya just said, especially the conclusion. The region is in danger, and I think that beyond the particular evolution of each of the countries, especially the countries of the Sahel, the issue is also the risk of losing all the benefit from regional integration on the economic side. But regional integration is also about peace and security, about collective security. It's about also having a more important weight in a world which is extremely divided, as we know, and the risk of having countries making very divergent geopolitical choices in terms of their partners is also increasing the risk of basically confrontation in West Africa between those who are aligned with the West or NATO and those who are aligned with Russia. And I think that is something which is very important when we think not just in the short term, but we think about the implication of the current situation for the mid and long term of the region in terms of collective security. What ECOWAS was about was also to be a framework where people can collaborate, where security forces can collaborate, where intelligence service can collaborate to have a collective security in West Africa. When you jeopardize that, you're actually creating a situation with more risk for the countries and for the population of the region. Just maybe you mentioned about the economic dimension. I think it is extremely important. In my opinion, the economic condition is actually probably the most important factor in the explanation of the security and political instability that we have in the Sahel countries, especially when you look at what's happened in the rural areas in 20 years in terms of absence of transformation. Then you can understand how easy it is for any armed group to be able to recruit people when you don't have infrastructure, you don't have a real connection with the state, because you don't have water, you don't have the basic things that people expect. You didn't have them in most of the rural areas in the region. So I think economic inequalities are definitely one of the most important structural explanation of the situation that we have now.
Thanks again for that elegant series of points there. Paul, just briefly, as Gilles mentioned, Russia. Is this an opportunity for Russia, and what's happening to the French and US presence?
The immediate news of the last few days is that Niger has demanded that the US, as Hidayat referred to, pull its 1,100 troops out of that country. And that does mean that all three central Sahel countries, if they want the, shall we say, the high tech or the heavy equipment side of outside military support, they are turning to Russia. And obviously, as is well known, Wagner has been well established in Mali for 2 or 3 years now. There are reports of the Wagner group, which has now been, since the death of Prigozhin last year, has been sort of brought much more closely under the Russian government military command structure, now extending its tentacles of presence into Burkina. There's been some sort of Russian military agreement with Niger as well. But when you look at the sort of things that groups like Wagner offer, it isn't really the kind of all-round overall support for security that not just the French or the Americans to some extent were offering, but perhaps more interestingly, MINUSMA in Mali, although sometimes criticized for not, the UN peacekeeping force, although sometimes criticized for not being as forceful as some would have liked, it was actually also trying to support governance in fragile areas and public services and things like that. And somehow that all-round approach to security, so that security isn't just about force, but is actually about helping to support social cohesion and public services, that's something that the Russians are not really offering and can only really be done by the region and national forces with what you might call positive external partners.
On that rather euphemistic last note, I think we are going to have to stop, but it's brought us back very neatly to the social and economic questions and security questions that have really been running through this. An absolutely fascinating discussion. A huge thank you to my guests, Gilles Yabi, Hidayat Hassan, Paul Melly. Do follow them all on X, and their details will be in the show notes. And a reminder that you can find all of our podcasts on all major podcast platforms, as well as through our social media. So please do like, follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. To read more from our work, our experts, to see our events, and to read up on our Africa program, don't forget to visit chathamhouse.org. For now, from me, Bronwyn Maddox, goodbye. See you next week.